We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by a returning guest, Anthony Tucker, who is the Labour Party's candidate for Earlsdon in next year's local elections. Welcome back to the podcast, Anthony.
Thank you for having me again. It's great to be back.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to stand in next year's local elections?
Oh, thanks for the question. I think for me, it all comes down to representing my local area. I live in the ward. I live in Earlsdon ward. I'm very proud to live where I am. And knowing the great work that our other Labour councillors had been doing, I wanted to join the team and give what I could to make the area where I live that much better.
What do you think are the priorities for people who live in Earlsdon when it comes to the council and council elections?
I think they want a council that reacts to their needs and isn't afraid of thinking outside the box. We have seen the reaction to the climate emergency has elicited an awful lot of activism from within Coventry and indeed within Earlsdon ward. So schemes including greener housing, greener transport and the provision of electric charging points, for one example, is something that Earlsdon residents have demanded more and more. But also we're blessed to have a lot of great community groups who have helped keep people fed through food banks, who combat isolation with the elderly and who have formed mutual aid societies to combat the problems of coronavirus. And I want to be a voice and a beacon for those to help them, help the people of Earlsdon by cooperating with the council.
What are your feelings about the makeup of the local council at the moment? Where do you think there are issues in terms of their connection with the local community? Do you think there are issues in terms of their connection with the local community?
I mean, I can only speak for my ward, but we've seen a fantastic improvement in recent years. My colleagues to be, hopefully, won their seats the first time ever. My ward used to be three Conservative councillors, and then for the first time in 20 years, we managed to get a Labour councillor elected in 2017. And then we managed to do it again the next year. So fingers crossed we can do it again. And that more cooperative ethos has really tied into some fantastic work. I'm really lucky, Becky and Kindy, and I'm hoping to be able to work with them in many years to come.
Now, of course, as you mentioned there has been in the past couple of years a great deal of success for the Labour Party in your particular part of Warwickshire. Why do you think that there has been this change in support and this renewed support for the Labour Party in the Earlsdon area and around it?
I can only say that I'd like to think it's because people are attracted by our policies, because we are trying to engage people in the terms that they care about, not rather trotting out old slogans, but engaging people in new campaigns. I think it's really a testament down to the excellent candidates and above all, our fantastic volunteers who have really said no to naysayers and defied them and campaigned in an area that for many years people thought would always be Tory, would always be blue. So it's their victory, really, more than anyone else's.
Now, two of the issues that have perhaps dogged the Labour Party in the last few years have been accusations of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and, more recently as well, transphobia in the Labour Party. How well do you think the Labour Party has dealt with these issues, and how would you ensure, if elected, that you would be able to ensure that these issues were dealt with properly?
Thank you. Yeah, no, I have absolutely zero time for anti-Semitism or transphobia, or those who would seek to deny its poisonous influence in our politics. I think from talking to my friends who are in the Jewish Labour movement that they're encouraged by the steps Keir has taken so far in expelling anti-Semites, in dealing with the culture that has taken root in certain parts of the party. More can always be done, but there's been a positive reaction so far, and all I can say is I'm willing to play my part in ensuring that the Labour Party has the stain of anti-Semitism removed for it forever and for good. As far as transphobia is concerned, this is something that I have to think about a lot when talking to the trans members of LGBT Labour West Midlands, of which I am one of the co-chairs, and it is profoundly worrying that what started as essentially a fringe movement in the start of the last decade has now ballooned into a fundamental attack on trans rights. I'm proud that the party has, and indeed recommitted to this week, reform of the Gender Reform Act. I'm profoundly disappointed in what the government is doing in not merely in denying trans people the reforms they have asked for, but also in attempting to play different parts of the LGBT community off against each other. I think there is still plenty more we can do to tackle transphobia in the party, and I have no time for those who seek to deny it. But I'm always hopeful for the future. LGBT Labour stands entirely behind the trans community. I'm proud that we're led by an exceptional trans woman who's dealt with a vast amount of flack on this very issue. And I'm hopeful for the future. That's going to require engagement with all parties and, above all, action.
Hmm. Now, of course, we've mentioned coronavirus and the local elections have, of course, been delayed. They were meant to take place this year. They're taking place next year because of coronavirus. What impact do you think coronavirus has had on Earlston? And what do you think will be the impact next year? Do you think that it will still be as much of an issue next year?
I think certainly from what I've heard from neighbours, from friends, and the limited circle of people, of course, we're allowed to see at the moment. I think what the impact of coronavirus more widely on the area has been that people have realised how much we rely upon one another, how much we need that circle of friends and acquaintances to really build and bind a society together, and also how frightening it's been for people who for the first time have seen the cracks in the social security net, for example, which have grown up since 2010. I hope that not merely can we overcome the virus, but we can also build that better, that we can create a fairer society where the possibility of facing mass unemployment or botching the response to a pandemic, where these cannot even be imagined, let alone happen as we see today.
How do you think the government has dealt with the response to the coronavirus? Do you think that they have reacted poorly? What are your thoughts?
I think I'd split this into two parts. There's communications and there's actions. I think the initial advice, stay home, protect the NHS, that was a clear message. But since that was released in, must have been May time, we've seen a real lack of clear communication. Too often, different areas have been told different messages. We were all told to stay in our homes. Then we were all told to go to the pub. And now we're all being told to stay in our homes again. And I think it's that confusion which is wearing down people's patience. And that sounds trivial, but of course it's dangerous. If people are not prepared to go through with the viral control measures we need, then the virus will not be under control. So I think there's been a real lack of communication over the last few months, and certainly a lack of clear communication. In terms of actual actions, I think that a lot of what the government has done has been necessary, but it's often been implemented badly with no reference to local leadership. The way some northern councils and indeed councils in the Midlands saw on the front page of the Times today what was happening to their areas before they'd even been told speaks volumes of how badly coordinated a lot of the actions have been. I think we were too slow off the mark in January. We should have been making preparations then instead of in March, which is when Boris Johnson chaired his first COBRA meeting. And I think, sadly, it's to be told out in the number of cases, the number of deaths our country has seen in comparison with comparable European nations or countries like New Zealand.
Now, the government have criticised the Labour Party in terms of their response for perhaps being too much pointing out errors in hindsight and this kind of thing. What is your reaction to that? Do you think that the Labour Party's response has been helpful? They've given the right response?
I think throughout this, we've tried to take the mature response that the seriousness of this emergency requires. It's not been a question of scoring points, rather saying that, yes, we share the government's ambition that we get the virus under control and we save lives. I think anybody would agree with that. But at the same time, as the opposition in a democracy, it is our duty to point out when the government is getting things wrong, when measures aren't working, or when, like I said, messages are being badly communicated. I'm glad that, while I'm sure it's frustrating for many people who want to see us constantly rip into the Tories about everything, that we've chosen our battles, we've raised the important points about controlling the virus, and above all, we've kept conquering the pandemic in the forefront of our minds rather than scoring political points at every opportunity.
Now, of course, next year is not only local elections in England, but of course there are parliamentary elections in Wales and Scotland. What are your thoughts on Labour's chances in those two elections?
Well, not being Welsh, not being Scottish, I suppose I'm not an expert, but I remain hopeful. I think the wave of support that has come back to the Labour Party in the last few months, judging by the polls at least, I'm hoping that that can turn into real gains on the ground. That means in English local elections, it means in Scotland, and it means in Wales. If that doesn't happen, then it's for Scottish Labour and for Welsh Labour to examine what goes wrong. But we have some absolutely fantastic campaigners and some brilliant candidates in Wales and Scotland and across the whole UK. So I remain very optimistic.
Do you think that in terms of the next general election, that Labour's pathway back to power is going to be very much through Scottish seats and those seats that are made up the so-called red wall? Or do you think that Labour perhaps needs to turn its attention to other areas that it perhaps hasn't been as prominent in, like the South West?
I mean, I always believe that there is nowhere that's unwinnable for us. It's about the messages you put out, it's how you explain your policies, and above all, what you promise the country. I don't think that this idea that Scotland is lost forever is true. This isn't. This is something that people like to say, but I don't think it's got any basis. The idea that red wall seats are lost forever is also a nonsense. If you look at where we were in, say, 1983 or 1987, and then compare the sort of places we were winning in 1997, it's transformative. And that's the kind of massive gains we're going to need to go from 203 seats to 350, 360 seats we need to govern. It's an absolute massive challenge. It's a historic challenge, but it's one I think we can make.
Now, of course, next year we will also be seeing more of the effects of Brexit. And it's looking like we're going to leave the European Union without a trade deal between the UK and the EU. What are your concerns about that for Earlston and the West Midlands in general?
I mean, how much time have you got, really? it's wholeheartedly disappointing not to see that we're not going to get a trade deal as we were promised, but that the government, indeed the Prime Minister himself, is ripping up the very withdrawal agreement that he himself negotiated and was so proud about. It does quite beg a belief when you have a government that thinks it can promise to break international law and then also get a good trade deal, which is what the people of this country need. Two big concerns which are very much come to my attention and people mentioned to me. One is on food standards, which seemed like such a salient issue 4 or 5 years ago. But now the idea of chicken washed in chlorine or hormones injected into beef is now really worrying for people. Mm. I think we all fundamentally care about what goes on our plates. And this idea that our excellent food standards could be traded away to try and get a trade deal with the United States is fundamentally worrying. And the other one, which I have to mention because, of course, it's the region of business, is the car industry. The West Midlands is the exporting hub of all of Britain, and the car industry is a central part in that. It not only does it support jobs directly, but the skills it fosters, the investment it brings in, means that technological startups and connected companies across the entire region benefit from our car exporters. And of course, that's so tightly tied into our web of trade and commerce across the entire EU that realistically, it's going to be those manufacturing businesses, the very same ones the government claims it wants to champion, that will lose out if there is no trade deal signed.
Now, you mentioned the car manufacturing industry there, and of course, proponents of Brexit and of a no deal scenario have suggested that, it'll be easier without all this red tape for Britain to be able to export cars across the world and won't have any of these restrictions and all that sort of thing. What do you say to that argument?
I think that the people who make that don't tend to understand the process by which we make cars in Britain. The idea that we construct whole vehicles like we did in the 60s or 70s is fundamentally flawed. The cars built in Britain today are often assembled from parts that have crossed international boundaries half a dozen times. They rely on the sharing of intellectual property between the EU and Britain. I think that we may end up exchanging the existing bureaucratic regime for one that's far, far denser and more difficult to deal with if we just discount the idea that the car industry must be protected. The revival of the car industry in Britain and in the West Midlands has been one of our great success stories over the last few years, since the 1990s really. And I would like to see it continue to flourish. And I can't see that happening without a trade deal.
And of course, one of the other concerns that has been voiced regarding Brexit has been the relationship between the United Kingdom and Ireland, and in particular, the relationship between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Now, one of the things that has brought this concern is the Internal Market Bill, which is going through Parliament at the moment, which opponents of which suggest will harm the Good Friday Agreement. If the Good Friday Agreement is in some way in danger through the government's action, what do you think Labour's reaction to that should be?
I mean, the only thing we can do when it comes to the Good Friday Agreement is defend it wholeheartedly. It has been the keystone to peace. It's what's made the troubles for the likes of you and me something that's historical, not in the news every single day, as it was for our parents. No, I'm so proud that the Good Friday Agreement was signed by a Labour government, that Mo Mowlam put her name to it and has brought a far, far more peaceful presence to the island of Ireland and communities in Northern Ireland specifically. This idea that we can somehow get around it or ignore it is fundamentally wrong. There's far too many people, I think, on this side of the Irish Sea who are putting their ideas, their abstract concepts of what trade should look like above the lives and security of the people in Northern Ireland.
Now, turning away from Brexit for a moment, of course, this November, in 27 days, in fact, we will be seeing the US presidential election between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Just in general, what are your thoughts on the US presidential election?
I suppose my first thought is, has it really only been 4 years? It seems slightly a bit more like 40, but that's the effect of having Donald Trump as president of the United States, I think. I suppose the risk is that we all get incredibly excited about the prospect of him losing and then he wins. But to credit Biden and Harris, they have a commanding lead in the polls, more so than Clinton did, or indeed even Obama did in places. And more to the point that the messages that we've seen this week, I'm thinking of Joe Biden's speech at Gettysburg example, have been about unity, have been about healing those divisions that Trump has opened up. So I'm hopeful, but I'm not going to put any money on the result.
Now, of course, you mentioned Senator Harris there. And of course, yesterday was the vice presidential debate between Senator Harris and Vice President Pence. Do you think that the contrast between that debate and the first debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden shows something that is perhaps wrong with our politics, that, on one hand, we can have debates that are perhaps not entirely without disagreement, but are well-mannered. But at the same time, we can have debates that are just complete and utter dumpster fires, for want of a better phrase. Do you think that that's something that's an issue with our politics at the moment?
I don't think it's so much an issue with politics in general. I think it's an issue with Donald Trump, that nobody else would think that they could get away with acting like that. I think Biden did a heroic job of keeping his cool throughout the whole process, the sort of quality you'd actually need if you're going to be commander-in-chief. And the few moments when he did get annoyed, I think he echoed what many people were thinking. But again, even in the vice presidential debate, Pence is a cleverer man and a much, I think, what you might call a much more traditional political operator. But the way he talked over Kamala Harris was absolutely disgusting. It just goes to show that the contempt that some men have for women in politics is never going to, isn't, well, hasn't gone away.
Now, of course, if Joe Biden wins the presidential election, he will be faced with Brexit and the potential for a trade agreement with the United Kingdom. What are your thoughts about a potential Biden-Johnson relationship? Do you think that Biden may be able to curb some of the excesses of Brexit that perhaps Donald Trump has encouraged in the British government?
I mean, I think this ties in very much with your question on the Good Friday Agreement, that I think that if we completely break all our promises to our neighbours in Ireland, the chance of getting any deal out of any American presidency is frankly minimal. Of course, it's not just a potential Biden presidency, it's also the states, the House and Senate we've got to think about. But I mean, I would like to think that a Biden-Harris victory is going to show the likes of Johnson and Mr. Cummings that their politics of shouting and ignoring science is ultimately unsuccessful. Hopefully that would make them reconsider, but I'm not enormously hopeful that they would.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's great to have had you on, Anthony. I've got one final question for you. Now, of course, we have been discussing your run, your candidacy for next year's local elections. So my question to you is this. If you are successful in being elected, becoming a councillor, what victory meal would you most like to have if you win?
Oh my God, the agony of choice. I was going to say, can't I have another one on complicated geopolitics? I could probably give you an answer for that. So much choice, but I think I'd like to take my partner and our sort of closest friends and inner circle for the campaign team, COVID permitting, of course. And I'd like to go to the Bombay Palace, which is just on the high street outside us. It's our absolute favourite curry place. And it is delicious every time we go.
Well, that sounds like an excellent meal. And if people want to find out more about your campaign, where should they go to find out more about it?
Oh, thanks. On Twitter, I am Ant for Labour, at Ant for Labour. And on Facebook, my page is Ant for Earlston.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.